basic needs until they can find work in a in an economy that one hopes might be recovering, but the data for which is yet sort of, well, less than clear. Right? And that it's terribly interesting. I didn't know you could shame a pig licking. But apparently they have been. I guess maybe the natives are restless even in places that have conservative family values like Alabama-stan and Mississippi-stan and Georgia-stan and the place, you know, the very beating red bloody hearts of teabaggery. But at least that was the news that was being reported a short time ago, that there will be a vote, a House vote, on this piece of legislation. We shall see. We shall see. Now, in other, I've got a story that's kind of a leftover from last night, but it's a story that needs mentioning, needs to be put out there. It's the story of Kevin William Harpum. Do you remember Martin Luther King Jr. Day 2011, January 17th, 2011, when they were getting ready to parade in celebration of Dr. King's birth in Spokane, Washington? And it turns out a backpack bomb was found that could have maimed, crippled, and killed God knows how many participants in the parade. You know, Martin Luther King Day. What Ron Paul, in his newsletter some years ago, referred to as Ronald Reagan knuckling under and signing into law Hate Whitey Day. That's how Ron Paul, libertarian, that's how Ron Paul thinks of Martin Luther King Day. It's Hate Whitey Day. You know, Ron Paul, libertarian gynecologist. Hey, I mean, just a question for the ladies in the audience, the women folk. Really? And you know, there's a couple of repig-licking conservative, white, pasty-faced, doughy gynecologists in their caucus. There's Tom Coburn from Oklahoma. And I do believe, yeah, because they talk all the time, you know, Dr. Paul has delivered millions of babies. And this is just a general survey question for Thorn in the Side Thursday. And it's for the women folk. Would you let a right-wing repig-licking conservative anywhere near you if you were in a set of stirrups? Not trying to conjure up any images or anything, but honestly, would you? I mean, God, that's like, I don't know, that's like a, it's like letting an eagle be a proctologist, you know, with the claw. Just bend over, sir. No. But, how did I get off on Ron Paul? I know how. He has said, you know, I played you that clip last night of him talking to Ari Velshi and creepy old Emperor Palpatine Darth Sidious Ron Paul getting bent out of shape when Ari Velshi dared to question him about his, newsletters. The ones that referred to things like Hate Whitey Day. And I guess the, I guess it's just getting a little bit uglier for Dr. Paul, Dr. Sidious. Because, among other things, CNN's Gloria Borger asked him about it. And he, how can you tell? I mean, Ron Paul's just a, he's a cranky old freak. so it's kind of hard to tell when he's not being cranky, but yeah, he got kind of cranky about it with Gloria Borger. This won't take long. Assuming it starts. Someday. Oh, dear. Maybe I should have rebooted the computer. Well, you'll have that.
There are reports that you made almost $1 million.
Really? $1 million? Doing what, Gloria Borger? Well, we'll find out presently. Yeah, here we go.
There are reports that you made almost $1 million off of them in 1993.
Oh, I'd like to see that money.
In nice, thin silver dimes, I'd like to see that. You know, you can buy a gallon of gas with a silver dime.
Of course he made money off of those hate-filled, racist, bigoted, prejudiced newsletters. That's why they went out, because every one of them had a, can you please give to help keep the Congress white with Dr. Ron Paul? Yeah. But he doesn't like being accused of making money off of his former racism, or what is, well, it's, come on, it's his present racism. It's just kind of closeted. Yeah, closets aren't just for gay folks, they're for racists too, and apparently Ron Paul is trying to desperately get back into his.
So you read them, but you didn't do anything about it at the time.
I never read that stuff. I never read it. I was probably aware of it 10 years after it was written. And it's been going on 20 years that people have pestered me about this. And
yeah, because see, that's what it is. It's pestering, Dr. Paul. You put out newsletters that were filled with just racist filth. And now you claim you never read it? So, in other words, somebody could have been writing these things for you and saying that Dr. Ron Paul believes that there's a race of men in the trees, and Dr. Ron Paul believes that we are about to be imminently invaded by aliens from the planet Norblap Zimblod. Head for the hills. And he just wouldn't have known it as long as the checks were clearing, right?
Did the checks clear? Oh, good. Send in my next patient. I hope it's not one of them dark ones. And you've been pestering me about this. I never read that sort of... What kind of a president would he be who doesn't read his own materials going out to his alleged constituents?
I'm just asking.
CNN does it every single time. So
well,
when are you going to wear yourself out?
I mean,
out?
When you say it's... No, but
when
you
gonna
know,
do that?
Is it legitimate? I mean, is it a legitimate question to ask that something
no,
went out
when you get
your
the
name?
And when you get the answer, it's legitimate that you sort of take the answers I get. You know what? The answer is, I didn't write them. I didn't read them at the time, and I disavow them.
I wasn't there. I didn't do it. And even if I did do it, I was only following orders.
That's the answer.
Well, it's just a question. I mean, it's legitimate. It's...
Well, keep telling him it's legitimate. He's going to keep telling you, Gloria, that it went out under his name, but he never read it. Come on. At least George Wallace had the... What? Honesty to own up to his racism. And he later on was said to have had a sea change in his thinking. But not Dr. Paul. No, he's gonna take this all the way to the newsletters that were mine and under my name and everything, and I was paying somebody to write them. But I never read them. One of these days I gotta sit down and read them. I can't. Wonder where. There's a lot of things that I need to read. I plan to finally get through Moby Dick. You know, that's a tough read. That Moby Dick. You know. And all those free market whalers out there being attacked by those god-awful whales in the sea. I've got to read that. I'll sit down and, you know what, I'll read these memos where I was saying all these nasty racist things that I never read before. I'll read them after I finish Moby Dick, and maybe Bleak House and Nicholas Nickleby and the Epic of Gilgamesh. And, you know, I've been a very busy doctor, and there's a lot of things I'd like to read, but...
It's legitimate. These things are pretty incendiary. You know, the
because of people like you.
No. Come on. Some of the stuff was very incendiary. And, you know, saying that in 1993 the Israelis were responsible for the bombing of the World Trade Center, that kind of thing. So, Goodbye. All right.
Yeah, goodbye. Right. Goodbye. I'm taking my microphone.
I appreciate your answer. I appreciate your answering the questions, and you understand it's our job to answer.
Thank you.
No, he doesn't understand. He's a nasty old reconstructed racist, and he doesn't like being confronted about it because he doesn't have the courage of his convictions. He's a cut-purse racist. He's a sneak thief racist. He's a shiv-between-the-ribs racist. He's not a straight-up Lester Maddox, George Wallace, in-your-face racist. No, he's the worst. He's the worst kind because he'll let you think that, oh, yeah, I'm a dedicated civil libertarian. And then, well, you just got to wonder what kind of raisin young Rand Paul got. But no matter what, he says he is damn sure not going to tell anybody who those people were who wrote that newsletter. Jim asking Ron Paul, was he in Bruno? Maybe not Bruno, but maybe he was in, what was Sacha Baron Cohen's previous one? Yeah, and Jim's point being, was he in Bruno? What an idiot for being set up. And it is kind of reminiscent of an episode from of Sacha Baron Cohen's, isn't it? But it's only a setup if you don't, if you have no reason to see it coming. And instead of dealing with this stuff on its face and up front, Ron Paul keeps trying to pretend it didn't happen. And that he didn't have... I mean, it was his newsletter. It just was. And he could very easily say, well, here's the guy who wrote it. But the problem is, even if he identifies someone else as having written it, then he's going to have to explain how long he remained on his payroll after he wrote it, or why he wasn't fired, or maybe the fact that he just stayed on the payroll even though he penned this filth. But that's just who Ron Paul is. Remember, his son, Rand Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist, learned at his knee. And it was the learning that he got from his daddy that caused him to tell Rachel Maddow that, no, you know, the Civil Rights Act should never have been passed, that the free market should take care of that kind of thing. But I guess I'm sort of running afield on this, because I was actually starting out talking about Kevin William Harpum, who actually pleaded guilty for planning to detonate a bomb during the 2011 Martin Luther King Jr. Day March in Spokane, Washington. He was due to be sentenced on December the 20th, and he was sentenced. And this is one of those that you can file in the win column, because the federal judge who sentenced him sent him up the river for hard federal time for 32 years. Kevin Harpum is now trying to appeal because he thinks his sentence was too rough. He also said, and this is the important part of the story, in offering his statement to the judge of why he filled a backpack with explosives and set it to go off next to the Martin Luther King Jr. Day parade in Spokane, Washington, he said, I was making, pay attention to this, this is so important, I was making a statement that there are people out there who don't agree with these ideas. Which ideas? Well, the ideas for which Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. lived and died. You know,
those wild-eyed radical liberal ideals, like the idea that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. That one ought not be barred from participating in one's polis simply by virtue of the color of one's skin, that people ought to be judged by the content of their character and not by the color of their skin. These are the things that Kevin Harpham disagrees with and wanted to send a message of his disagreement. He said, because you got to understand, his bomb was full of shrapnel. And he said it was just supposed to explode against a wall and not hurt anybody. Now that is curious, because all of the shrapnel in his pipe bombs, in his backpack bomb, all of the shrapnel had been dipped in rat poison. So that even the most tangential contact with it could cause horrible problems, bleeding problems. You know, rat poison is roughly the same thing as the prescription medication used as a blood thinner called Coumadin. It's called warfarin, is the chemical name. Kevin Harpham was honorably discharged from the Army. He had no criminal record. And Federal Judge Quackenbush, really, Justin Quackenbush, said, "I am distressed that you appear not the least bit apologetic." And in so doing, handed down a sentence of 32 years. And it'll be hard for Mr. Harpham to get out, hell, even in 16. And this is what needs to happen with racists. Once they've taken some overt step. Judge Justin Quackenbush went on to say that Mr. Harpham was influenced by, and this is a quote, this is a write it downer. He was influenced by a shrill and caustic and vitriolic culture fueled by talk media. He means talk radio. He means Fox, Radio Rwanda. Because, see, I don't care who that person is. There is nobody on the liberal left or progressive spectrum, whatever, that urges violence, that urges anyone be hurt or killed. And there's certainly no one on the liberal left who thinks that Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday holiday should be referred to as Hate Whitey Day. I've listened to a number of liberal and left and progressive talkers. I've known some and call them friends. I've never heard Rick Smith urge violence. I know I myself have never urged violence. Mike Malloy hasn't. Guy James never did. No one on the horn did. I've never heard Stephanie Miller to, you know, she's funny. That's just beyond her. I've never heard Stephanie Miller do it. Even Big Eddie Schultz, I've never heard suggest that anyone should be harmed for simply having a different skin color. Tom Hartman certainly never has. Peter Werby, no. None of them, past or present. Oh, but Lordy, just tune in and spend a couple of hours with Sean Hannity, or Flush Flemball, or O'Reilly, or God knows, the Beckerhead. Remember, this is Washington. This is where the Beckerhead grew up. And it was Glenn Beck who exhorted his listeners to take to the streets and kill people who worked for the Tides Foundation. This is Glenn Beck who told his viewers and listeners that he would like to personally murder Michael Moore. You know, there were books by Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity in the possession of a man named Adkins. Not to mention, Bernie Goldberg's 100 People Who Are Ruining America hit list. Mr. Adkins, having been fed a steady diet of right-wing hate, took a shotgun into the Tennessee Valley Unitarian Universalist congregation in Knoxville, Tennessee, and started blowing people away during a children's play. Annie, as a matter of fact. And this is, of course, what I submit to you, Federal Judge Justin Quackenbush was referring to when he said that Mr. Harpham had been influenced by a shrill and caustic and vitriolic culture fueled by talk media. He added, that is contrary to what this community and this country is about. His prosecutor, Thomas Perez, Assistant Attorney General for the Civil Rights Division in the Obama Justice Department, said acts of hate like this one have no place in our country in 2011. And just a reminder, the pipe bomb was, in fact, loaded with lead fishing weights that had been coated in rat poison. He meant to maim. He meant to wound. He meant to kill. And he hoped to kill people with darker skin than his own. And now he is going to spend 32 years in the care, custody, and control of the Commissioner of the Department of Corrections, therein to be kept in accordance with law. And segregated from the society, he hoped to, at least in his small part, destroy. Kevin Harpham, enjoy the quiet time and the time away that you have. I don't know if his heart will change. You can rather hope that it might. But at least the people of Spokane, Washington, can rest a little easier. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello?
Hey, Jim, what's up?
Well, first, Merry Christmas and Happy New Year to you and your family.
And to you as well.
By the way, that was Ron Paul and Bruno.
Was it? No, wait, oh my God, I thought you were kidding.
No. Is it? All right.
Yes!
Yes, he was in there, and, you know, I can understand him getting Shannon Doherty in there into his home without any furniture, and so he had these Mexican laborers cleaning his pool, and so they became Mexican chair people, and Shannon Doherty had to sit down on one because these guys were on their knees and backs, and that was those were his Mexican chair people, and he was talking about how other movie stars had one. They were just totally indispensable.
And then, you can't get along without them.
Right, the Mexican chair people. And he said that Ashton Kutcher and Demi Moore swore by theirs. But nonetheless, it went on, and he has this interview with Ron Paul in his hotel room. and then moved from the sitting room of the hotel room into the bedroom, and Sacha Baron Cohen begins to strip off and make all these provocative comments, and then, only then did Ron Paul realize, this ain't nothing but a bunch of queer shit. And I thought to myself, are you that dumb and stupid that you would be sucked into something like that without knowing what was happening? I mean, if he didn't think it was a setup, I just wonder how close he wanted to get to the actual situation. And then, you know, storms out, screaming all of what I just said. So, obviously, you know, he isn't particularly what I would call perspicacious or in any way.
Well, you know what, Jim? I think maybe you've earned the evening's first toaster, because this is kind of an indicia that where this is one of those where there's smoke, there's fire kind of things.
Well,
that maybe there was some reality that maybe he had a little more involvement in those newsletters than maybe folks let on.
That's what I'm saying. I mean, you know, he said, oh, no, I knew nothing about it. But, I mean, they were written under his name, and if he doesn't realize that anything that goes out under your name, you're going to have to take assume responsibility for, my God, I mean, that's just absolutely crazy. I mean, he's saying that he didn't say it, but it went out under his name, right?
Yes. And, I mean, if you do a little searching, there's, oh, what the stuff that was said there is
terribly inflammatory.
Yeah, well, you know, like the L.A. riots only calmed down when the welfare checks came out, and that the D.C. area of Adams Morgan had become the D.C. zoo.
Oh, that's ridiculous. Listen, Adams Morgan Day is right around Labor Day, and I've been to that several times when I lived in Washington. And basically, Adams Morgan is an extremely diverse neighborhood. Lots of Latinos, lots of people live up there. And it is an incredibly wonderful street fair. I mean, that's the reason it's one of the, you know, if you look at highlights of things in Washington to do, Adams Morgan Day is mentioned there as something to, if you're in the city around Labor Day, the weekend around Labor Day, that you are invited to attend. And enjoy all the, you know, ethnic foods and things like that. I mean, up toward Adams Morgan, Columbia Road, and off of Connecticut, you know, you have a lot of, Ethiopian restaurants and different types of, restaurants. And I mean, Adams Morgan is just known for its diversity and the, you know, the polyglots of people who live there, and it adds to the richness of the city.
Oh, it's a wonderful area.
Exactly.
Of course, I love D.C. generally, but it's not too far from DuPont Circle, is it?
No, you go right up. As a matter of fact, you go straight up DuPont Circle up Connecticut, and you veer off, and you go on Columbia Road, and you're right in the middle of Adams Morgan. You just basically get into DuPont Circle by the Metro Red Line, or you can go up Mass Avenue, and it takes you right up into DuPont Circle. If you want to go further, you can go up a couple blocks, and there's the National Cathedral at the corner of Wisconsin and Massachusetts.
Yeah, I knew the National Cathedral's up there by Wisconsin Avenue. And you might find this interesting. I just had a quick email letting me know that subsequent to the whole Sacha Baron Cohen Bruno fiasco, Ron Paul told an audience of you know, whatever his little acolytes are called, he told him, I should have punched him in the face.
Well, if the idiot had any sense, he would have known he was being led into a setup in which he would be made to look like a complete and utter asshole. Excuse my French, but that's the only other way I'd ever describe it. I mean, my cats would have set up to be more sense enough to be led into a setup situation like that, and when he's being filmed.
And, you know, just to give you an idea, I mean, I've mentioned a couple of them, Jim, but just to give you an idea of what went out under Ron Paul's name, here's a quote. We are constantly told that it is evil to be afraid of black men. It is hardly irrational. And then there's this. given the inefficiencies of what D.C. laughingly calls the criminal justice system, I think we can safely assume that 95% of the black males in that city are semi-criminal or entirely criminal.
And I want to tell you a personal story here. When I lived in D.C., outside my apartment, I dropped my wallet. I mean, it had everything, all types of DOD ID, all types of stuff that you would almost rather commit Harry Carey than lose, okay?
Sure.
And I was just sitting there wondering, fixing to start to call credit card companies and to call the security over to Andrews and stuff like that. And there was a knock at my door. And guess who had my wallet in his hand? A black man. A young black man. Not an older black man with white hair, the Uncle Tom type that people try to portray.
Right.
A young black man. The kind that would be accused of going in your window trying to take your TV.
Well, the kind that Ron Paul says that it's irrational not to fear them.
Exactly. And in the apartment complex in which I lived, it was half black. And I never had any problems with anything whatsoever with these people.
No.
They were kind. They were understanding. They were friendly to me. There weren't any racial problems there.
No, one of my favorite places to go when I'm in D.C. is down off of Thomas Circle. And it's a little basement restaurant and pub. And it's largely persons of color. They pour a mean drink, Jim. I swear they give you about a half a pint of liquor for $6.
Yeah, I know where you are. Been there.
And the food is just awesome. It's just a stone's throw down from the Washington Plaza. And it's one of the more of all the places I've been in D.C. And of course I haven't probably been to nearly as many as you. But it's one of the more pleasant, laid-back, and welcoming places that I've ever been. And yet I guess Ron Paul would just befoul himself with the gut-bending fear at the thought of walking into stands.
Well, you know, it's a strange thing because one day this other lady that I work with, who is whiter than the Queen of England and whiter than my sister, that's basically the way she is. Carol is her name.
Are you asserting there that we're talking about a really, really pale level of whiteness?
Whiteness in mentality and whiteness in skin and just whiteness in her total beliefs and stuff like that. But she and I had to drive over to the Pentagon, and, you know, I said, well, Carol, hell, I'll drive. We'll just go there. And we left Andrews and went down the Suitland Parkway, which takes you right into Anacostia. And she was going on about, oh, I'm scared to be going through Anacostia. I said, well, Carol, we'll just have to be adventurous today. That's all there is to it.
And I can hear you saying it, Jim.
Going off Sterling Fourth Drive, I turned directly onto one of those streets that go right into one of those crack dens.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a black prostitute standing on the side of the road. And so I said, Carol, ask this woman if this is the right, if we've taken the wrong road. And without even getting her permission, I hit the power thing and her window went down. And this lady was just as nice as she could possibly be. I mean, it was true. You could see she was probably out there on the stroll, as they say, and that was all right. And of course, Carol couldn't even talk. She said, why did you even open the window for that woman? And I said,
that woman.
Exactly, or for that lady. I said, you know, she was not out there to harm you. She was basically on the papers.
Out there to make a living.
Precisely. I said, you know, it's the oldest profession in the world. And I just found out from that experience that, you know, people will treat you the way you treat them. And if you give them attitude, they're going to give you attitude. And it's only natural for them to do so. But I found some of the most decent people in the world in Washington.
Sure.
Well, the white ones, I can tell you that, Bob.
Oh, yeah, no, and, you don't have to convince me.
Right. And I can remember when I got this invitation to attend Ron Ron Brown's funeral. Remember the Secretary of Commerce who died
yes.
in the Balkans?
Mm-hmm.
And standing out in front of the National Cathedral. It was a cold April day. And this black woman had a newspaper, and she said, "Are your feet cold?" And I said, "Ma'am, they certainly are." And she said, "Well, I have an old trick for you. Put some newspaper inside of your loafers." Because I just worn loafers instead of those little spongy corduroys that weigh about 10 pounds. But nevertheless, I mean, she was just very nice. And coming back on the metro, I had the program of the funeral in my hand, and there was a black lady sitting next to me. And she saw it, and she just put her hand in mine. She said, "You know, that is terrible." And I held hands with the lady.
And obviously you remember it to this day, Jim.
Pardon me, sir?
I said, obviously you remember it to this day, it had meaning beyond its own moment.
Yeah, and ironically, at the same funeral, I was seated next door to the mayor of Chicago. What's his name, Daley?
Yes.
And I just looked at him and I said, "Hello, Mayor Daley." And without my even asking him to do so, he grabbed my program and autographed it. And I said, "Sir, thank you, but I didn't ask for this."
"You done wrote on my program. I was going to frame it."
Yeah. I mean, I thought to myself, you know.
Well, I obviously I wasn't there, but I remember that funeral for a different reason, Jim. Because at that time I was doing a lot of traveling. I was on the road quite a bit. And we all know that sort of moth drawn to a flame, I can't resist listening to talk radio. And I cannot tell you how many times that year Rush Limbaugh tried to make political hay out of that funeral. And the way he did it was to say, my friends, I've seen the video of this. Now watch William Jefferson Slick Willie Clinton. He was walking along joking with his friends at the funeral of Ron Brown, but then when he realized the cameras were on him, he became very somber. You see, he's such a phony.
You know, I could have reached out and touched President Clinton and observed him very carefully, because he gave the eulogy at the service. And his words were something to the effect that, you know, how fastidious this gentleman was, and how no matter how he tried to dress, that this gentleman, Ron Brown, always looked so much better, because he had a good physique and he was a very handsome man. And Bill Clinton didn't make any political hay out of that. He was paying homage to a lost member of his cabinet.
It was a sad time.
It was very sad. It was very sad. I mean, the guy had been over in, I think, the Balkans, and he was trying to perform his duties there as directed by President Clinton or whomever. And
the plane went down in fog or something, didn't it?
It was just a real, real, real bad mess. And, you know, I was real surprised to get an invitation to that funeral from the DNC. Of course, back then I was a lot more active with the DNC and stuff like that. And, you know, I didn't make a big deal of it, because as a federal employee, you know, you're not supposed to, because of the Hatch Act and stuff like that.
Right.
But I asked Colonel Illing, my boss, and she said, "You know, Jim, I expected you to be going to this funeral, because I know you're a good Democrat. And you certainly could have the day off, and we won't even charge you leave."
That almost sounds like a better and more decent Washington, D.C. Can you imagine something like that happening now?
I don't know, Bob, but I know when I first went to, when the Holocaust Museum first opened up, I was one of the first people there on the day that it opened, and I spent the whole day there. And I brought back cards and stuff like that from it. These are postcards that were drawn by kids who were at Auschwitz and stuff like that. And I had graphics make up a sign in my cubicle saying that hate is not a family value.
You know, that's interesting you would mention that, because I was at a meeting last week when I was away from the microphone. And that is the one of the people that was there had a bumper sticker with that very line on it across his laptop. That's just kind of neat the way these things line up sometimes. And it's the absolute truth. Hate isn't a family value, but the number of people who would tell you that it is are far too many. Like this guy in Washington.
Exactly, and you know the thing about it is. When people saw that in my cubicle, my boss, Colonel Illing, and I didn't realize it, but she was Jewish. And she came up to me and said, you know, I really appreciate your putting this up there. And I wish more people would pay attention to it because there is so much prejudice here. And there is so much anti-Semitism, anti-racial, and this, that, and the other. And, you know, I'm glad you put this up. And, you know, it wasn't a particularly a feel-good moving thing for me because I had spent the entire day in that museum and I had sat in those cattle cars and lifted the stones from Van Poison concentration camp and gone through the entire experience. And that's what the Holocaust Museum is. It's more than just going to a museum. It is an experiential situation.
It's immersive.
It's totally immersive, and it was designed that way. And even architecturally, with these walls of steel and bolts and stuff like that, it wasn't made to look like a particularly pretty place, but nonetheless, it was designed to convey a message, and it was designed to commemorate a horrible thing, which hopefully would never happen again. Unfortunately, it has happened in so many ways.
And so many places.
There are so many different types of Holocaust that have happened since the Nuremberg trials and stuff like that. And it makes my heart, you know, absolutely break. But nonetheless, sharing those little stories with you, one about Ron Paul being so damn stupid and the other about my positive experiences with black people in Washington, D.C. And, I did play a joke on my father. He was alive then. And he was mayor of the town then, and Marion Barry had gotten into all this trouble with cocaine and stuff like that.
I will remember it.
And so I called up, and to these real conservative people, I would call up in different congressmen's offices, and I would ask them to please send pictures of these real conservative friends of mine back in South Carolina dedicated to them, my sister being one. And she was saying, why in the hell am I getting all this stuff from Ted Kennedy or from this, that, and the other? I mean, just to give them a little, it may have been in bad taste, I don't know, but it certainly gave them a run for their money. And I sent one to Marion Barry, and he sent one to my dad, and he said, why is Marion Barry sending me autographed pictures? He said, right now, I'm typing a letter of thank you to him, but please, do not do this anymore.
So, having raised you, he knew the wicked, incisive roots that your penchant for the practical joke can take.
Well, I inherited my sense of humor from him, but I mean, I didn't think there was any harm in it, and I just thought, you know, it would be. You know, just a laugh, something to brighten up the day's mail. But nonetheless, you know, it was.
Well, and just to take you back to the Ron Paul thing for a moment, with all of these comments that were made in his newsletter, which have been confirmed, Jim, in 1 year to have raked him in a cool $1 million. You know, when he said to Gloria Borger, "I'd like to see it." Well, look in your bank or in your mattress, Congressman Paul, because it's right there. The Texas Monthly was the publication that first sort of investigated and broke the story, and that's when he took quote unquote responsibility for the newsletters. But he also said, and this is the part when Republicans do it that always just slays me. He said, certain things were taken out of context.
Taken out of context?
Yeah. Now, how do you... Now, I've got one more of these phrases that appeared in his newsletter, and I'm just itching to find out, Jim, How do you take this out of context? Because this is a quote. He describes in his newsletter Martin Luther King Jr. as, and like I said, this is a quote, the world-class philanderer who beat up his paramours. Then he went on to describe him having seduced underaged girls and boys. Now, how do you take that out of context? Or better yet, I suppose, Jim, what is the context in which those words are okay?
Well, that's ridiculous. That's like Hitler saying, oh, everything I said about the Jews was taken out of context, you know? Who was this person that he was referring to as a world-class philanderer? Bill Clinton?
No, Martin Luther King.
Martin Luther King?
And by the way, did you get around to seeing J. Edgar? Did you say you had?
No, I haven't seen J. Edgar yet. No, uh-uh.
It was still playing a couple of weeks ago. It's worth your time, and definitely when it comes out on Netflix or comes out on video, it'll be worth your time.
I'm sure it will. I hear Leonardo DiCaprio does a wonderful job.
Magnificent job. And Naomi Watts. You'd never know it was Naomi Watts, but they can't make her unbeautiful.
And I think Helen Mirren plays his mother.
Not Helen Mirren. Judi Dench.
I mean Judi Dench. Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry.
And of course, if she appeared in a movie just long enough to be shown brushing her teeth, she would steal the movie.
Oh yeah, she's a wonderful actress. She really is. But it's really strange that he would try to disavow stuff like that. And who paid him this $1 million for this stuff?
The people that this thing went out to. And this newsletter.
And they believe it, and they accept what he says.
Well, if you get a newsletter saying that, remember Barbara Jordan, the congresswoman?
Yeah, I sure do.
If you get a newsletter that refers to Barbara Jordan as Barbara Morandan, and calls her the archetypical half-educated victimologist, and you put a check in the mail as a result of receiving that newsletter, Jim, I don't think I'm too far afield in suggesting that that's because you agree with that kind of language, am I?
Well, I think you're right on there. I mean, I don't put checks in the mail for anything unless I certainly believe in stuff like that, you know?
I mean, if you put out a newsletter that says, order was only restored in L.A. when it came time for the blacks to pick up their welfare checks, and you get $100 and $10 and $5 contributions back, it's because people agree with that. So how do you, when you, and I guess where I'm trying to go with this, Jim, is that no matter how many times he disavows it or says, I don't know who wrote it, he cashed the checks, Jim.
You know, that type of mentality leads me to believe in one phrase that I heard recently. The North may have won the Civil War, but the South won Reconstruction. Or that's something to think about, don't you think?
Yes, it absolutely is. And in many ways, you know, that's part and parcel of the argument that I've made, Jim, that certain parts of this country have never stopped fighting it. They may have stopped shooting, but I grew up with too many of those little cartoony front bumper tags that show the old grizzled Confederate veteran with his star battle flag over his shoulder, and the only thing it says underneath it is, forget hell!
Yeah, you're right. And those old attitudes and those old prejudices and those old hatreds, they just survive from generation to generation because the older generation inculcates the younger generation into subscribing to that, and they want to pass it on. And all they're doing is simply performing a bloodletting operation upon the body politic of their own country when they do it.
Well, absolutely, and that's the thing that's frustrating, because sometimes, and I remember when you yourself have said it, Jim, that there are things that only mortality can cure, that generations simply just have to go the way of all flesh.
Yeah, Khrushchev once said, well, there are certain things only the grave cures. That's what he dealt with it, yeah.
But in this instance, it is, and I know you must, growing up in South Carolina, you must have witnessed every bit as much of it as I did growing up in Alabama.
It is generational. It is handed down from generation unto generation like some precious legacy, so that you can have a 23-year-old kid in Alabama or Georgia or Tennessee or Mississippi or Alabama, South Carolina or whatever, marching up and down, reenacting the Battle of Busted Stump, and talking about how he reenacts under the Confederate battle flag because it's a matter of legacy, and that war wasn't about slavery, it's about economics.
Oh, bullshit.
You know, which if you've listened to Dr. Bill and Professor Keith, and I know you have, you know, they chapter and verse laid out the origins of the Lost Cause argument as having originated fully 10 years after the close of the Civil War.
Right. Now, you and I don't agree on Robert E. Lee. You know, that's one thing we'll have to disagree on, okay?
I used to be where you are. I used to feel like, you know, noble man, you know, made an ethic of blah, 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 blah. But the more I look at where this country stands, Jim, the problem that I have is that as long as we continue to venerate these secessionists, then secession will somehow itself be legitimized. And I guess that's the biggest thing. I mean, that's my biggest problem.
Robert E. Lee's parole came from, of all people, Ulysses S. Grant.
Yes, it did. I once learned that he never actually received his restoration of citizenship papers until after his death.
But I do know this, that at the first Episcopal service, when Robert E. Lee went back to, when he was back in Richmond, penniless and with nothing, and when he first went to the altar to take communion, or when the first black man did, Robert E. Lee was the one who joined him. I think there were a lot of conflicts in Robert E. Lee's mind about that, and I can't judge the man, and I don't believe in, you know, psychoanalyzing dead people, because that's kind of hard to do, but I take a little more lenient attitude towards him than you do, and that's just my position.
I understand that. I just don't, what I don't understand and what I don't, more importantly, don't know, Jim, is how this country is ever going to get over that, how it's ever going to get past it. You know, at the close of apartheid, with all the horrors that had been perpetrated in South Africa, they had a Truth and Reconciliation Commission that, and I'm sure I'll get an email saying, oh no, it's still nasty over there, Bob, or something like that, but they made an overt attempt to get past it. It involved immunities from prosecution, and everybody just had to come up and you know, it was a clearing of the air. And we have never to this day had that.
Well, you know, the longest journey begins with the first step, and that's what these people were trying to do over there. But in many situations with people below the Mason-Dixon line, or the cornbread curtain, as you have called it, or it's been called on your show, there are those people who simply don't wish to do that. They wish to keep these things alive. And I have family members that are like that. And I just ask them, you know, does it really give you a feel-good situation to have these attitudes and to engender these hatreds? I said, look at it from a very selfish point of view. You know, hatred and bad feelings, they don't hurt the feeling, the person you're hating. They hurt you, and they detract from your own store of energy and, you know, things that you could devote more positive feelings towards.
Absolutely. And by the way, I should let you know, you got a little fan mail this evening. Our buddy John in New York said, it's great to hear from Jim. I always enjoy his perspectives and his sense of humor. So,
well, Jim has a bizarre sense of humor, and Jim can be real cranky at times. And you know that, and I know that, and I have certain things that I hold.
But who among us cannot?
Well, that's true. And the fact that I'm back on your show and talking to you proves that, you know, I don't hold grudges, and I don't, you know, I respect other people's rights to do things, and if something isn't awry, I'll just tell you so. That's just me, my typical old ornery curmudgeon type of sense of humor. That's just me, and I've heard.
Well, I owe you big time for because at first I thought you were just making a reference, but no, Ron Paul really was in Bruno, and if there's anybody out there worth their salt, they will haul up that scene and start playing it all over Iowa. Of course, I don't know, with Ron Paul running out of the room hollering, that's a bunch of queers, it's queers, I tell you, queers. I don't know, that may get him more votes in Iowa.
Well, I don't think so, because, I mean, for him to be as woodenly stupid and as stupidly wooden as to be let into a situation like that in a hotel room, and you'll have to see it. I don't know if you have or not. You'll have to see it.
I will go forth and find it, absolutely. Jim, thank you very much, and a very happy Christmas to you if we don't talk again tomorrow night.
Okay.
All right, take care.
You too.
Bye now. Our buddy Jim, who brings a great deal to bear in the course of our attempts to understand this incredibly strange little world we live in. I just got this video, since we're talking about Ron Paul for some reason or another. I started out trying to talk about that hate-filled, rat poisonous bomber, but I diverted the conversation myself. Just got this video from Sandra, and it's from Meet the Press on December 23rd, 2007. It's just a minute long, and it is Ron Paul, and this sort of brings together two things that came up in the conversation with Jim. It is Ron Paul discussing the American Civil War. This might be a sit-down and strap-in moment. Now, remember, this is Ron Paul, who described Martin Luther King Jr. as having seduced little girls and little boys, who said the riots only stopped in Los Angeles because the blacks went to get their welfare checks, who said it is irrational not to be afraid of a black man. Okay, so that's the prologue. Here's the curtain coming up.
Intrigued by your comments about Abe Lincoln. According to Paul, Abe Lincoln should never have gone to war. There were better ways of getting rid of slavery.
Absolutely. 600,000 Americans died in a senseless civil war. No, he shouldn't have gone to war. He did this just to enhance and get rid of the original intent of the Republic. I mean, it was an iron fist.
We still have slavery.
Oh, come on, Tim. Slavery.
Wait, don't let that one blow by. Because there's a... what a moment that is. Why did Abraham Lincoln go to war? Why did the Civil War happen? This is Abraham Lincoln Ron Paul is talking about.
Absolutely. 600,000 Americans died in a senseless Civil War. No, he shouldn't have gone to war. He did this just to enhance and get rid of the original intent of the Republic. I mean,
to enhance and get rid of the original intent of the Republic. Grammarians, you know what we need? We need to appoint an official horn grammarian, because I can't do it on the fly, and we sort of need somebody who can parse this stuff at their leisure and get back with us during the course of the show. I've got a little problem with that phrase.
The war, he did this just to enhance and get rid of the original intent of the Republic.
To enhance and get rid of the original intent of the Republic. Which was it, cranky old Doc Paul? Did he want to enhance the original intent of the Republic or get rid of the original intent of the Republic? Because the two seem, forgive me, and granted I was only a C student in logic. Well, I got better. But you can't do both. They seem mutually exclusive to me. You can enhance the Republic, the idea, the original intent of the Republic, or you can get rid of the original. No, Abraham Lincoln was... Jesus, criminy. And this is someone who's in the lead in Iowa? It's another one of those knock-on-doors in Dubuque. Pardon me, ma'am. Are you a Ron Paul supporter?
Why, yes. Yes, I am.
Can I just get your picture?
Hey, what for, Shunny?
Well, I just want to show other people what Ron Paul voters look like. You do know that he hates Abraham Lincoln, right? You do know that... He has said awful...
Yes, I do know, and it's why I'm going to carcass for him.
There are those moments when you just don't... You feel like you're living in a country that started out as your country and now feels like something out of a Marx Brothers movie. Abraham Lincoln started the Civil War because he didn't like the United States. Because that's what that phrase means. That is sure as God made little green apples what that phrase means.
Civil War? No, he shouldn't have gone to war. He did this just to enhance and get rid of the original intent of the Republic. I mean,
Abraham Lincoln was an anti-constitutionalist. Oh, Timmy Russert, you tosser of softballs. How I wish you would have followed up and said, so you're glad he got assassinated, Congressman Paul? Or didn't we say that's a good thing? But no, Timmy Russert never did any of that kind of stuff.
It was about iron fist.
We still have slavery.
Oh, come on, Tim. Slavery was phased out in every other country of the world, and the way I'm advising that it should have been done is do like the British Empire did. You buy the slaves and release them. How much would that cost compared to killing 600,000 Americans?
But who would buy them, Ron? You're a freaking libertarian. It'd be unconstitutional for the government to buy the slaves and set them free. Under your view of the Constitution, the government wouldn't even have the power to do that. So are we to understand that Ron Paul thinks everything from waging war to paving roads is unconstitutional? But if he as president decides that he wants to spend money doing, buying all the slaves and freeing them like England did, that would have been constitutional because he said so? That's not a nation of laws and not of men. That is rule by dictatorial autocratic fiat. And yet all over this country, Ron Paul wanted, he didn't want us to go to Iraq. That must mean he's a progressive and a liberal and he believes in peace and Jesus Christ, somebody get out the tambourine and the harmonica and the guitar and let's play Kumbaya. Ah! And what makes me even crazier is that there are some on what we call our side of this debate who are saying that crap. Well, he hated the war just like Dennis Kucinich did, therefore he must be No, he's not! Dennis Kucinich is an enlightened man. Ron Paul has the enlightenment of a fire plug. With the water turned off. Because it's unconstitutional to have fire plugs in Ron Paul world. Unless the free market owns the fire plugs, of course, then it's perfectly dead. Well, yes, that's wonderful.
And where it lingered for 100 years. I mean, the hatred and all that existed. So every other major country in the world got rid of slavery without a civil war. I mean, that doesn't sound too radical to me. That sounds like a pretty reasonable approach.
You're running as a...
Jesus. Honest to God. It's too early to put the straw in the tequila bottle. Jim just did some quick on-the-fly research. Now, bear in mind, the number that you're about to hear is in $1,861. Not 2011 dollars that are pumped out by the Fed, and we've got to close the Fed, and where's my milk of magnesia? These are $1,861 dollars. I don't even know how you would convert them to 2011 dollars. I'll leave that to the folks with that skill set in the economics world. But Jim, doing some research on the fly, noting it would have cost $11 billion with a B dollars to have purchased the manumission of all the slaves in the United States. $11 billion. Jesus, do we even have a word for the number set that would be in? I mean, because it's got to be more than trillions.
Oh, but then we could have invaded Mexico and just taken the gold, and we would have been on the gold standard like Jesus wants us to be, and we could have paid for it, and you know, a thin silver dime would buy you a slave in 18...
Shut up, Ron Paul.
Libertarian gynecologist. I'm rich. I'm comfortably well off.
David in Tennessee noting, sadly, the preserving the mythic South. David named the subject of this post. Sadly, there's a 40-year-old that had been told for his or her first 7 to 8 years of life, racism was a good thing. Well, having not heard it from age 7 to age 30, these people began to hear those ugly ideas in an amped-up form at age 31. They had their chance again. They heard it from Flush, from Hannity. They heard Toby Keith talking about putting boots in posteriors, the sources of the horrid reintroduction of racism are manifold in this country, and it is done under the guise of freedom of speech. There will come a time when speech in this country becomes so abused that notions of freedom of speech will go away, and it will be because of the Hannitys and the Flemballs and the Savages and the Bortzes and the Betts. Because it is possible to abuse the freedom of speech. And to do so, well, note what Judge Justin Quackenbush said in Washington. That a man was moved to coat fishing weights in blood-thinning rat poison, pack them into pipe bombs, put those into a backpack, and leave it to detonate upon a group of innocent parade participants, that he was inspired to do that by right-wing hate radio. And sooner or later, somebody besides me is going to point out the fact that that is the 21st century equivalent of yelling fire in a crowded theater. That sending arguably unstable or semi-stable individuals with little education and lots of free time and motivation out to do in the enemies the them that they hear about every day when they turn on their radio and hear things broadcast over the airwaves that you and I own, we the people. Someday somebody else is going to figure out that that is, in fact, a straight-up abuse of the First Amendment. But then how many times have I noted that the First Amendment is little more than a life support system for the religion industrial complex? Because it is. Anybody figured out what $11 billion would be in 2011? I can hardly stand to contemplate the thought. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob.
Hey, Sandra.
Hey, yeah, no, that figure, you know, there's a formula to figure out what money was and you factor in inflation, but I don't really have it off the top of my head. You know, it's one of them problems that you do and you're like, oh, God, you don't ever want to do again. So.
Well, I mean, $11 billion in 1861 would be just zeros across the room now, wouldn't it?
Oh, yeah, it'd be a lot. Well, actually, you know, a slave is cheaper today. Human slaves are like a fraction today of what they cost in antebellum America. I don't know if you know that.
Yes, well,
it's like if you paid $1,500 to one, the equivalent now would be $90. I remember reading that in one of these developmental economic books. You know, it's shocking.
Well, and that goes hand in hand with the fact that there are more African Americans in our prison system now than actually were alive at the end of the Civil War.
Yeah, but anyway, I thought that video was really telling because he's not even making any sense. It's like, well, wait a minute. You're not going to have the government doing any kind of operation like that. It doesn't fit your worldview, Mr. Paul. You see what I mean? It was just absurd listening to that. It's like, you're not going to, you wouldn't in any way condone the government buying people to settle a conflict. He's full of shit. His shit was well exposed in that video. You know what I mean? I'm like, oh, wow.
I don't think I've ever seen a better exposure of his hypocrisy.
Yeah, no, that was outrageous. It was just like, what are you talking about? I looked at that and I thought, oh, yeah, you know, I know Bob's gonna like that. Because it's just, it just says everything. He's absurd. And if you couple that with, you know, his like, oh, my God, the white people are just realizing that he's racist shit that's going on right now. Because I'm laughing. I'm like, oh, come on. You going to bring this up again? You know, I mean, anybody with any sense.
But the thing that was new to...
You know that he's racist. I mean, as a... I'm sorry, just on the strength of who he is and who he's related to and where he's from, I'm taking it as a given. His generation and stuff. And it may be wrong on my part, and I forgive old white people in their 70s, but that's just, you know, a quick observation right there. Because...
Now, the one thing that I didn't know or had never read was that he made a cool million off of that filth,
well,
Sandra.
No, and you make a good point. No one's saying that, you know, did he say that, oh, he'd never seen that money now? Isn't that what he's saying, though?
Yeah, that's what he said to Gloria Borger.
Right.
Borger.
Yeah. Yeah, no, the thing is, though, but, you know, what he said, you know, it just rings too true. I don't care if he didn't write it, but his the people he run with, that Lou Rockwell? Are you kidding me with that guy? Come on now.
And he worked for Ron Paul, right?
Right. I don't, you know, it's like, who cares who you ascribe it to? They're all part of your peeps. And people are bringing it up now because, unfortunately for Ron Paul, his politics are running against the neocons and the security state apparatus. They're not going to have him. So they'll dig up whatever. And these naive 30-something white people and younger who are all infatuated at Ron Paul, I mean, they disgust me.
Oh, I thought Malloy was going to have a fit lecturing them the other night, bless his heart.
Yeah, no. But it's, I mean, because I don't, you know, a libertarian ain't worried about what I do with my uterus. You understand what I'm saying? So right there, I'm like, what's up? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He seemed to be real concerned about that. And he's racist. I mean, it's just like too many things are sort of pushing against that, quote, libertarian streak. It's BS. That's what that is.
Well, you can't be a libertarian and think that Martin Luther King's national holiday is Hate Whitey Day.
Well,
because
yeah.
If you're a civil libertarian, you ain't supposed to be no racist.
Well, no, but also, but this is the same person who's talking about, you know, some sort of buyback scheme for Chatto. It's like, oh, my God. So, you know, everything that comes out of his mouth is sounding really dubious. And if you stack it all together, it equals racist.
Well, get this, Sandra. Michael
in the closet.
Exactly. Michael in Sebastopol just wrote in, and he did some quick inner tubing. And he said, according to the Internet, the 1860 total United States federal budget was about $260 million.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, yeah. Okay. So now, we're in the realms of outer space again with what the value is, which is why they went to war. You understand what I'm saying? It all just plays in. It's like, yeah, damn Skippy. I'm not giving up them Negroes. Pow. You know.
Yeah, let's shoot at that. Hey, look, there's a convenient federal fort out in the harbor. Let's take pot shots at it.
And to me, it just sort of reaffirms why the war was so brutal. That's a lot of money. That's a lot, giving up a lot. So, yeah, that's what people go to war for. He tripping. And the whole thing with England giving up their slaves. I mean, come on now. Once again, we run smack into the wall of there is no cohesion in America outside of the almighty green. So anytime you have divisions up in this mug, it gets real nasty. That's why I'm scared of where we're heading with now. This ain't Japan. There is no cohesion.
Well, you know, it was a couple of nights ago, Sandra, when we were talking about Birmingham, Alabama. I learned a little something else about Birmingham, Alabama.
Oh, okay.
You're going to love this. Because the people, and I admit, I heard it on NPR, but the people who were in charge of putting together this story said the problem with what I'm about to describe is that there are no statistics on it being used because no one is aware of anybody else doing it. The city of Birmingham put the Birmingham Police Department into every high school in Birmingham. And in the course of a relatively short period of time, 100 children have been sort of arbitrarily pepper sprayed. They're pepper spraying Birmingham high school students. The story that they used to illustrate it was a young woman who was being insulted by a high school student who was male, and she got very upset and she was crying, and the hall cop came up to them and said, "Miss, you're going to have to calm down and stop being hysterical," and then hosed her down with pepper spray. And so the SPLC, the Southern Poverty Law Center, has filed a suit that it hopes will be turned into a class action suit to stop this stuff.
Well,
but isn't this hand in hand with a collapse? I mean, I know you and I kind of hammer on this, and probably me more than you, Sandra, but isn't this just indicia? Isn't this just evidence of what collapsing culture looks like?
Well, no, but and also it's just sort of, you know, the expansion of what I call containment. Because when I used to live in Oak Park, which is a predominantly black area in Sacramento, you know, I was always struck by how the police don't really police. They just kind of contain. And that seems to be the way they operate when they're around people of color, if I may put it politely.
Well, needless to say, the young woman was of color, as was the young man.
Right. And so when you decide to turn our brutal, historically brutal police force into institutions where they didn't used to be, oh, shock, horror. All of a sudden you got kids arrested, sprayed, shot, hit, and all sorts of other shit that goes on when you have to deal with the pigs one-on-one.
Oh, I know. And, Susie, what did you learn in school today? I learned when the officer says for me to quit crying, I better quit crying or I'm going to get pepper sprayed.
Well, and that's just, you know, especially for kids, you know, of color. And when you shouldn't have police like that in the schools. The schools aren't there for that. And all the schools are becoming militarized. That's one of Arne Duncan's main things. He's really quite keen on, you know, making these poor schools, especially, you know, reflect some sort of military ethics. So, you know, it's the fine line between prison and school. It's all blurring.
And what they offered as a sort of sidebar to the Birmingham story is the fact that on January 1st, the entire school system of Kansas City will be disaccredited, and it has financial ramifications. It has obviously educational ramifications, and the thing is, they've had all of those free market miracles there. They've had their charter schools. They've had means of putting children from failing schools into successful private academies, and you know, look what it's brought about.
Well, all it's going to continue to bring about is the destruction of public schools in this country. I mean, you know, once again, with no sense of history, we didn't used to have public schools. You know how in America everyone always thinks that as things are, they always were in this country? You know that problem?
Oh, yes.
Okay, well, we didn't used to have no fucking public schools. That was a social engineering, you know, at its best, I may add. So as it goes, it can go away again. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I'm really done with this kind of like these institutions are here forever. No, if they're not nurtured and taken care of and paid for, well, they're going to go bye-bye and replaced by whatever corporate predator is waiting in the wings.
And
that's how it works.
Yeah, because before there were public schools, there were religious schools.
Well, and there
and
was
then
no
we
schools.
We And then
basically, no schools.
Right.
I mean, that's what I'm trying to get at, is that the majority of the people didn't have access to. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, Abraham Lincoln came into this discussion. That's the Abraham Lincoln story. He had no school. He walked how many miles to borrow and return books and sat there reading them by firelight. That's a determination to learn, but it's also a reflection of someone who has the leisure time to do it. Now, on the other hand, when the minute you're old enough to carry the bag, you're out in the field with mama chopping cotton, well, you know what? I don't care if you walk 15 miles to get them. You're not going to have any time for teaching yourself to read by the fireplace. And so there is an inherent element to that that suggests that some people in this country are worth educating and others are not.
And when you combine that with the deindustrialization, then the powers that be are like, well, we don't want these people to have education. So you have to factor that in, too. None of this stuff is on accident or as haphazard as it may look.
No, I mean, look at the school system, and I don't know maybe if your nieces will be coming up against this when they start high school out there where you are. But we've had four kids now go into ninth grade at the same high school, and in ninth grade they are told to pick a career track, and the course of their coming 4 years of education in the high school are determined by the career track that a 13-year-old chooses. And so, you don't need to write that good to be a coal miner, or, well, you don't need that much science if you're going to be an artiste.
Or those programs they track in Chicago and Detroit where they, you know, got Walmart sponsoring it. You know where them kids are going to end up.
Hell yeah.
And then, your kids, if they have you and Agnes to sort of hopefully point them to the right curriculums, but not all 13-year-olds have that sort of advantage, and have to make that decision right there. Yeah, that's a bit much.
And it bothers me with and I have massive frustrations with this school system because it's only gotten worse since our school system was declared to be a failure by the State Department of Education. Dropout rates have gone up, absenteeism's gone up, grades have gone down, teen pregnancy's gone up, violence in the schools has gone up, as we have witnessed personally.
Wow.
And so it consequently bears gravely upon my mind when I find myself going hammer and tongs at them, because I feel like I'm playing right into the hands of the corporatists and the people who don't believe in education. Because it's hard for me to look at the way the public schools are being run, at least here where I am, and say, well, this is a rousing success. But I get the sense that it is a designed failure, and it goes back to, poor old Teddy Kennedy, God or whomever rest his soul, being hoodwinked into participating with George Bush in that godforsaken No Child's Behind Left program. Because that set up every public school in this country to potentially become a failure.
No, those programs are just horrific, because I don't know what my nieces were asking me today about, and I was trying to explain to them, that when I was their age, I remember my teacher, every teacher had their own curriculum, and they just couldn't even wrap their head around, the no worksheets or no open court or all these other sort of corporate bleeding programs that the kids are saddled with today, my third grade teacher, if you act up, next thing I know, I was sitting there copying the dictionary. I mean, everybody had their own way back then.
I would have rather had the beaten. You don't know how much dictionary I copied.
Exactly. So, it was a whole different setup when we were coming up. I don't remember any kind of, handouts or sort of established anything. You know what I mean? So just that in itself, and that's a couple of generations ago, it's changed so dramatically how the kids are being educated. I shake my head. I'm like, wow, I don't even know how these kids are supposed to have any critical skills at all.
I don't want to use my kids as examples. It's kind of unfair to them because they're not here to defend themselves. But we were looking into some grade issues because one of my kids just took the state benchmark exam for 10th grade biology.
Mm-hmm.
And placed like second in the state. Okay? Well, this particular child of mine has periodically been not doing well at all in 10th grade biology. And we went in, we sat down with the teacher, and we said, why is this? And it turns out that there are elements they have to teach according to standards that are set, and one of the standards is that you have to have group work.
Well, yeah, see, I don't know what the, you know, I don't, every state has their own standards, but you know, have you had a chance to look at the standards for your state?
Yes.
Okay, good, because, you know, you can...
And every class has to have an element, a certain amount of class time that's devoted to breaking into, like, small groups and learning that way. The only problem is if Kid A busts her butt, Kid B kind of mails it in, and Kid D just says, screw it, I ain't doing nothing, and the average group score winds up being a D, the whole group gets the D.
Yeah, okay.
And I don't know what are you trying to teach? Because it obviously is not the subject that you're trying to teach. It's something about, what, human psychodynamics, Sandra?
If they were concerned about the group dynamic, they would have to sort of lay out the proper way of engaging in group dynamics for it to be a success. Otherwise, it's going to fail every time. It's a real skill to work in a group. You see what I mean? And it's no wonder that, I mean, I don't know. You know, that doesn't really make, that's quite difficult to do. And especially if you're the one doing all the work, and you're how old? 15, please.
Yeah.
About to.
And you get handed the D. And
yeah.
Yeah. Why not just say screw this and walk away?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I don't. You know, like I'm always inclined to be sympathetic to the teaching professor, the teacher.
Yeah, me too.
They know what they have to go through, and it's, you know, they're just sort of between a rock and a hard place at this point, because the sort of standards that they're required to present to the students, wow. I mean, it doesn't leave much room for their own professional development.
And,
you know,
God help you, why do you have art class? Why do you have speech class? Because you know what? You can't put questions about speech or art or even really band or drama or journalism on a standardized test. And, of course, whether it be West Virginia or California or anywhere, Texas or anywhere in amongst and between, everything is about the standardized test.
Well, that's bizarre that your girl scored. I mean, I don't understand. That seems problematic. If she is able to master their state standard tests and still struggling in the actual class, it's usually the other way around.
But what that shows us is that the student is able to comprehend the material and hand the material back, so to speak, but that the lollygagging and fripperies, that maybe the student's not so good at those.
Which
goes back to something that I've argued and I've talked a bit to Dr. Bill at some length about. We've got all these people out there who revere, and God knows we've been guilty of it, but I think we're also a little more realistic in our conversations on the horn, revere the founders and the framers and the Enlightenment geniuses, and you can never overestimate that, who pulled this country together, and yet we have no interest in educating our children the way that these people we revere were educated. And I find that kind of mind-boggling.
Well, yeah, I mean, the U.S. system, you know, has taken a lot from Prussia, which I think is where public education had its origin, but that system there was also there to placate and mollify the students, too. That has to be remembered.
Right, to keep them from chopping any heads off and stuff when they get older.
Yeah, that was the reason. I mean, you know, the system was admirable in some aspects, but it definitely did have a purpose of mollification. But anyway,
but it, you know, it's like David in Tennessee kind of reminds us both. He just said a minute ago, the folks that want it all want the following: for-profit schools, for-profit prisons, for-profit everything. And just as a reminder, they want it all. And this is what it looks like when you see them getting their way in wanting it all.
Well, and also, which, you know, I mean, I haven't really seen this sort of, you know, all these people are talking about the loss of civil liberties and whatnot. They don't seem to be making the connection, at least which I'm making with it, is that forget the war on terror. I just think it's an apparatus being set up to deal with, you know, the coming economic collapse. I don't mean that it's all at once, but just the restructuring of our economic life in that you're going to have people never working and 30% reduction in wages.
And just, well, let me just put this question to you, because you and I are of the same age, and we experienced different sections of the country in somewhat similar fashion. What is it about a successful middle class and towns with little local businesses on their main street and schools that function? What is it about that that our betters hate? And why is it that they do hate it? And why is it that it has to be converted to this system that I think you're right in describing, Sandra, but I fail to understand?
Well, because it goes back to what you were saying before about people wanting it all. I mean, you know, let's not forget that the boom period for white people after World War II up until about 75 was an abnormality in history. What we have going now and going forward is more in line with what exists in the world. You know, small numbers of people who are affluent and large numbers of people who have nothing. So this sort of booming middle class that America developed, you know, was an abnormality in history, and it served this country really well. But there's always been the vultures on the top. And for some reason in 1980, everyone sort of lost their minds in this country and decided to revisit the teens. I don't even know what else to say.
Well, I think about it in context with, like, Prop 13 out in California.
Well, yeah, and if you keep that in mind, yes, the people voted against lowering their taxes in California, if you can imagine that. They ran this shit for years. It wasn't overnight. But every time people would say, no, we don't want our taxes lowered. So it was, you know, it was a slow process that seems to fall in line with the idea of when the generation dies off that suffers, you get the repeal of Glass-Steagall. You understand what I'm saying by that?
Yeah, I do. It's that
they're not around. They're not around anymore.
Yeah, it's that failure of transgenerational wisdom. It's
right.
The stuff that didn't get passed along. It's the grandmothers who never sat with their little 7-year-old granddaughters and said, "Honey, never again."
Right. So, I believe that. I think that especially for a sort of invented project or whatever, like we have here. So, you know, it seems to make sense that it would all unravel, because it's, you know, it's been a good 80 years, you know what I mean, between when it was a complete misery here for the vast majority of people. And
yeah, none of my grandparents on either side would have in a million years voted for a Republican, even had the Republican been, I believe, Jesus Christ. They would,
yeah.
Because they had it.
Right, so I mean, I'm sure there's all sorts of other reasons that we can throw in, but I mean, because there's no way that the country would cut its own throat like this if it had, you know, if this amnesia hadn't descended upon us, along with a very well-funded, media that's sort of passing for with constitutional protection that sort of turned against us too. I mean, you know, I just think there's a handful of institutions that have sort of turned against the American people. And, you know, what we get now is boner. I mean, this is what is passing for leadership now. And, you know, looking at that idiot, I just shake my head. I think, oh, my God, is that what's in charge?
And he blinked. I mean, I was right. I mean, from what I heard,
he blinked.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that was pathetic. You know, it's like they really, you know, they thought they could go, I guess. So they were wrong on that one. But listen, I was wondering, did you hear about this article of these rich assholes bitching?
Yes.
I mean, some of the it was one quote here that was just killing me. Oh, this billionaire is saying that it's a simple fact that pretty much all private sector jobs in America are created by the decisions of the 1% to hire and invest, since they're confident in the future more than any other factor will drive those decisions. It makes little sense to undermine their confidence by vilifying them. And it's just, it goes on and on.
Was it the Lowe's guy or the Home Depot guy who recently said, if I hear one more thing about income inequality, I'm going to vomit?
Oh, yeah, no, it's too much. And this one guy said, this other guy, Cooperman, said, he can't walk through the dining room of St. Andrew's Country Club in Boca Raton. Excuse me, I have seen that place. I have seen it. So that's why I was laughing. I'm like, oh, no. And he said, without being thanked for speaking up, at least four people expressed their gratitude while he was eating an egg white omelet. St. Andrew's Country Club, you ain't going to get nothing but 1% thanking each other. I mean, the absurdity of it. I mean, these people are disgusting. That's why I wrote, forget Occupy Wall Street, just bring out the guillotine.
Yeah, because get the pitchforks, get the torches.
Because they are just disgusting. It's like, wow.
Well, you and I discuss Europe at some length. Look at the hissy being had in Great Britain over the prospect of a 3-cent transaction tax stock trades?
Yeah, no. I mean, because it's just, you know, these rich people don't understand the reality of their policies. Britain, they can't afford to have another riot like they just did. They can't do it. These people got to pay something up, and they're fighting it tooth and nail. And the spectacle of the central bank, what did they cough up, €500 billion?
Yeah.
That whole spectacle is really disturbing, too, because let me get this straight. You're lending all this money to the banks that have shitty assets that they can't sell, so they load up their shitty assets to the central bank in exchange for this cheap-ass money. Then they're supposed to turn around and do a carry trade and buy some bonds and get 5%. Loan for 1%, carry trade for 5%. But wait, it don't make no sense, because they're not going to buy sovereign debt with that free money, are they?
No, that's straight out of Catch-22. That's buying eggs for 5 cents in Malta and selling them for 2 cents in Pianosa, and everybody makes a profit.
And the worst thing about that whole plan is that, wait a minute, the European Central Bank isn't the Fed. The Fed has a sovereign that is U.S. behind it. Excuse me, did the European Central Bank get a backstop that I missed? Did I miss that show?
No, because I don't think the memo got written on that, Sandra.
I thought I had missed the show where Germany said, yeah, we'll backstop it. Oh, but wait a minute, they are. So it's a joke, okay? And I'm like, wow, you know, they seem to be all thinking it's all good and well. I just think it's just shuffling the decks on.
Well, I don't know if you were listening last night, but I was kind of blown away by that one story toward the end of the program that I mentioned about the suicide rate in Greece.
Yes, that's terrible. I saw that story too. I was gobsmacked by that.
And again, these aren't the hyper secular. The church is a sort of charming anachronism French. Okay. This is Greece. This is literally the place where Christianity was invented. But truth be told, it ain't Rome. It's Greece. It's all those little churches in Thessalonica and Philippi and Asia Minor and Athens and Corinth. And they still take their Greek Orthodox faith in large part quite seriously. So when you off yourself, they really believe they're going to hell. Now, what does that say about life, the life that has been imposed for the foreseeable future on the Greek peninsula, that you would rather go to hell than continue to live on planet Earth? I mean, we're not talking about people, because I'm not one of these who jumps in there every time somebody offs themselves and says, well, you know, they were clearly mentally ill. That's just too convenient a diagnosis. I believe that, I mean, there's a lot of sane people killing themselves in Greece.
Yeah, no, but that is just austerity, you know, that is a byproduct of this horrible pro-secular shit that they're in trying to enforce, which is just not going to work. I mean, I don't care how much loans they give to banks. Excuse me, central bank, why aren't you giving the loans directly to the sovereign states? That's my question about that whole process. What's up? Reason why is because the banks are just taking care of the banks like they always do. And all the loss and risk is being transferred yet again to the public.
That's some hellacious dandy fine corporate socialism, isn't it?
It's outrageous. And, you know, another thing I wanted to know if you had seen was, did you know that the city of London has categorized the Occupy movement under domestic terrorism?
I saw mention of that, but I didn't see the details. The mention alone was rather chilling.
Well, I can send you the link. It was on, you know, Yahoo News. But the thing is that what's that thing that Obama's signing with his signing statements, whatever the fuck he's doing with it?
Yeah, the NDAA.
Don't tell me. Because that has some vague-ass language in it about what is a terrorist. And, you know, where is Orwell? He must be spinning, turning, flying. Because...
No, at this point, he's drilling.
Yeah, this shit is just something out of... It is out of Orwell. I mean, I must have read 1984, you know, at this point a handful of times, so I can't get enough of it. And it's just too... I don't know if that man was some sort of, you know, weird-ass Nostradamus visionary. He's sitting there seeing shit in his mind's eye because it's too creepily coming to be.
You know, I think it's clear he was a visionary.
You know?
But as is so often the case, there's no magic involved. It's just a matter of having the clarity of mind to sort of run things out 8 moves ahead on the chessboard.
Yeah, well, Orwell was amazing anyway, just by virtue of that he was actually a practitioner, too. He just wasn't an armchair.
Right.
So he had a real good understanding of, shall we say, both sides of it.
And there's, you know, there's some to be said as well for Aldous Huxley.
Yeah.
And
he was a little bit more of an elite. Although Orwell went to, you know, a nice school, but I hear what you're saying.
Well, just the idea of a medicated populace.
Yeah.
True. Because there's, you know, there's two. If you consider Huxley and Orwell together, they are two. They're two hands of the same body. And if you can't happy pill them, then you bring in the Orwell left hook.
The room.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, anyway, it's just. So, you know, it disturbs me to no end that we have a bill coming out with such vague language about something as important as your freedom. And I don't mean it in this, I just mean just your physical freedom, that there's a possibility of an apparatus being put in place in this country where you just held forever. You know what I mean? I just can't even wrap my head around it. It seems so foreign, you know, in what I've learned about living in the U.S.
Well, it's not America.
And this is notwithstanding the horrors of being a person of color in this. Let's separate that because, you know, we get to the sort of inherent flaw of the U.S. every time we talk about life for people of color in this country. But... with that,
right, and you know, I think it's Malloy who said it so many times about all you white folks who really didn't understand, you're about to have your chance to.
Well, that's the thing, because you know you can always turn a mirror onto, you know, what goes on in communities of color to get the real story in this country, but the pretense now is unraveling. I guess that's what I mean.
Yeah. The mask, the rubber mask has been pulled off, the curtain has been pulled aside. And
the fact that it's being taken care of by some black man, listen, that's enough to drive a person over the bend.
Well, that's one of those where you go to the church of irony and you start and you yeah. acknowledge the existence of the god of irony and move.
It's some crazy shit for sure. But anyway, I don't know if he signed it yet or what the deal is. I haven't really.
Well, I'll be interested to see the signing statement, of course.
Yeah, they keep talking about that, and that's giving me the creeps because.
Well, you know, we didn't like him when George was doing them.
Well, I'm not liking him hearing about that now.
Right, that's the whole point.
Oh. God, you know what?
But God forbid you should criticize them because a bunch of the Obama can do no wrong crowd will be on you like a duck on a June bug. And that's not to say, you know, I understand that there's a dynamic on the progressive left. You know, I say that every time, but you know, come on. I guess the progressive middle would probably be more like it. That you know, there are those of us who have problems with what he's done. There are those who will forgive him anything, and there are those who will not admit that he is even a member of the human race. And they're all on our side. You know, I'm not talking about the weirdos. You know, I'm not talking about the people who set off bombs in Spokane, Washington over Martin Luther King Day.
Right. Well, you heard about that dude, right?
Yeah. You know, 32 years, and you know, he wanted to make a statement by making it blow up against a concrete wall. Well, as David in Tennessee noted, concrete, you know, rat poison doesn't do squat
right,
to a concrete wall.
Where was the terrorism charges, though?
Exactly.
I mean, what's that? What, I'm sorry. I'm like, I'm missing something.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm not. I don't mean to get heavy-handed with this, but he was the wrong color. And, you know, he was an Army veteran, and, you know, we don't want to kick him while he's down. Let's just give him 32 years and move on.
Well, and speaking, and this is just another thing that's just, I don't know if you saw this, but you know, I just felt sick when I clicked on what this bitch looked like. Sensenbrenner talking about Michelle Obama. You see that shit?
Oh, well, no, I saw Sensenbrenner shouting down,
No, he was saying that she had a big butt and she has no right to talk about.
Do who?
Exactly. I'm not stuttering up in here. What the fuck, man?
That yeah. crazy old. Well, you know, add him.
What the hell he look like?
Add him to the glory list, would you?
That rancid old bastard. I was like, you are not talking about Ms. Obama. It's like, what the? I don't know. I was just horrified. I'm like, oh my god. You know, ugh.
And this happened when?
It was in Politico. It was crazy. I just, you know, I don't know, it was, you know, him bitching about her because she's, you know, talking about nutrition, and I guess he's a, you know, it's like getting in the way of his campaign finance contributions from, you know, the agro corporations. I really don't know what's the motivation, because I was too horrified looking at that pig and thinking, oh my God, what are you talking about? You know, you don't look, yeah, anyway, it was just hideous, you know, anyway.
That's astonishing.
I can't even.
Well, I mean, you'd like to think. But again, you know, that goes back to what David in Tennessee said about, you know, up to age 7, they were taught that racism was a virtue. From age 8 to 30, they were told, no, it's not. And along comes this new sort of renewed culture of it. And suddenly they think they'll take it out for a spin a second time. That's where that crap comes from. It is. It's like, because when you mentioned Sensenbrenner, the first place I went was the business of Steve King tweeting during the SOPA hearing. Okay? And that was, oh gosh, it wasn't Sheila Jackson. Was it Sheila Jackson Lee? Or was it, I'm sorry, I've lost the name, from Southern California. But she was offering, remarks about how pernicious that Stop Online Piracy Act is, and it is pernicious. You know, at the same time that Hollywood is calling for it, their profits are higher than they've ever been before.
Well, yeah, exactly. It's too much. It's just, yeah, that thing, that has to fail. That is unbelievable, that SOPA thing.
And so Steve King tweets that he is just bored to tears by what she says. The congresswoman finds out about it and levels a broadside at Steve King, and Sensenbrenner makes her apologize. I mean,
so it's just.
And of course, Sensenbrenner has since apologized in his own right for the big butt quip.
Well, what, you just found that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it don't really matter. It's just more the sort of, you know, complete historical disregard of black people, especially and black women, their weird-ass issues around them. I'm sorry. I'm just, it makes me so nauseous. You see what I'm saying?
Well,
I think about it, I'm just like, oh, God, you know, it's sort of...
And it's also the old business about not being able to unring a bell, Sandra. He said it, and then he apologizes for it, and in the interim, he has probably gotten God knows how many tens of thousands of dollars in campaign contributions from right-wing faithful saying, well, you know, you can't even talk about a woman's big butt. It's that political correctness that's ruining America.
Well, if it was just as simple as that, but we know it's so loaded and so weird when it comes out of their gobs. You know what I mean? When it comes out of the mouths of those types, it's always so loaded, and it's just the whole thing is completely icky. Did we have a chance to talk about Denver and their inability to support the It Gets Better campaign?
No.
Yeah. So, a lot of the baseball teams did videos for it and, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
But somehow the NFL, and they can't get it together to do it. And Denver, you know, is like, you know, stammering and stuttering along trying to explain why. And it's just like, So... None of them funding.
No, we can't encourage young gay people not to kill themselves.
Right.
And file that in the same drawer as the Christian Lifeway bookstore that would rather see a woman die of breast cancer than for her to have a screening at Planned Parenthood.
Right. So anyway, I just thought that was interesting about, I didn't realize it was NFL-wide, but it seems to be the whole league seems to have issues with. And that's funny because, you know, well, I would bet you there's plenty of queer people in the NFL organization.
Well, there's no reason to believe that that gay people are not in the professional athletic population to the same statistical degree that they are in the normal population.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. And it's just kind of like, and I also think, when I think about Denver, I'm like, ugh. Can you imagine you're just a player there? Say you are queer. You're already in a closet. What if you happen to be a non-believer? I mean, it must be stifling in that organization, you know?
Oh, God.
It's horrific. Listen to this fool sing and, you know, what if you...
Yeah, you're still not over that, are you?
No, I'm not. I'm appalled by it, you know. I'm very appalled by it. And it's more in terms of, well, what about the other people and their belief system? How are you able to... hang in that situation. You know,
well, I don't know. Is there anybody named Mustafa Muhammad Kamal playing for the Denver Broncos?
You know, there's always some. Negroes converting to Muslim. You know.
Yeah, I'll bet he gets his walking papers from Denver the minute he does it.
Well, I'd be curious to know because, you know, we've had a history of like black athletes who nation of. Islam and the like, so it's not like it's...
Oh, I remember the histrionics over not putting one's hand over one's heart for the... or not standing up for the national anthem in the NBA. Jesus.
Oh, and that was right after the whole... soon after the 9/11, so everyone went berserk. I remember that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Because, of course, it's worth remembering, and I think we've had a conversation about this along the way, that our sports, whether it be... And this goes back to a letter from... our buddy Scott in Sweden, who sort of did some reverse cultural immersion after many years and was stunned to see the degree to which, for instance, college football has been turned into, the pregame's been turned into an orgy of nationalism. I mean, my own alma mater, West Virginia University, not too long back, they've got a magnificent, underappreciated marching band. They really are something. But their pregame or halftime show, you know, a salute to the armed forces, and they turned the marching band into a submarine marching down the field with the waves going over the... It was really impressive as hell, you know, the formations, and there was a battleship and a tank that went down the field. You know, God! But it's all militarized, and you know, to go back to the issue of gays in athletics, you know, there's an argument. I mentioned the 10% and the normal population, Sandra, but there's an argument to be made that the actual percentage of gay people inside athletics is far higher than the representation in the at-large population. Because it's athletics, it's regard for one's body, body consciousness, appearance, that kind of thing. You know, things that the Budweiser swilling slobs generally don't go in for. If that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, but it's just sort of, you know, it's amazing what is sanctioned, because the fact that people have to be subjected to that Tim Tebow. God, you know, it's incredible.
And the thing is, the nature of the discussion after he got his ass handed to him last week, and again, I advise people in the audience who hate sport to understand this is not a sports discussion, but a culture discussion. The theme started up, well, you know, John Fox needs to give him a vote of confidence that he's their quarterback going forward. Well, look, John Elway's a Stanford guy. And there's not much, I don't know, maybe could they trade up to get Andrew Luck? You think John Elway might like to have Andrew Luck? Who has a magnificent throwing motion, who can hit receivers, you know, on the fly? But they're all out there being apologists for poor little Timmy, you know, like the NFL is Pee Wee League where everybody gets a trophy.
Yeah, big bad hoodie and his nasty quarterback, you know, boo-hoo. Come on. I didn't know it was that kind of narrative, really.
Yeah, oh, yeah. It was...
Is he playing this weekend or Saturday? All the games are on Saturday, right?
Yeah, they're playing this weekend. I forget if it's the Chiefs or maybe the old ladies' school for the deaf and blind or...
Well, who the Chiefs? Didn't they just come off of beating Green Bay or something? Really?
Yeah, while everybody else was paying attention to what was happening in Denver, I was sitting there going, "No, come on, guys,
yeah,
really, this is not going to happen."
Yeah, that was like, "What the?" At any rate, and then the other story about football that had me rolling was Indianapolis. I'm like, "How you going to win? What the fuck?" You know?
And then they did.
They did, but, you know, I think they might have to send Stiffneck to another team.
Well, if he plays again. If he plays again.
You know, don't these freaks play? They don't really care. He's going to have to play because it's...
But, Peyton may be at the point where doesn't matter how many endorsements he's got. If the doctor looks at him and, you know, out of earshot of the ownership, of course, says, son, if you put the helmet back on and you go back out, you may come off feet first and never move again.
Wow, well, because I heard that he was throwing the football around. You know how they do that.
Oh, yeah, but somehow I think that's for PR purposes. Let's see, Saturday, December 24th at Buffalo, and then Sunday, January 1st, home with Kansas City. Now, Buffalo has been on, you know, they started out like a house of fire, beat the Patriots, all that fun stuff, and poor Chris Berman was on ESPN saying, oh, it's good to see the Bills coming back. And then they went on, what, a 6 or 7 game skid?
Oh, that's right. It was going to be the Bills all the way. I remember all the chit-chat. And ain't no big crickets since.
And the crickets aren't feeling very well. So it's, yeah, Saturday is at Buffalo, and then the following week, Denver is home to Kansas City. So, you know, what? And of course, the theme out of that will be that Timmy had an off day, but he's back to his winning ways. But you know, if some, honest to God, Sandra, if we don't get a little, Raiders got to step up.
No, we need another beatdown, two in a row. In fact, it'd be great for a succession of beatdowns because that has to end. I was sort of more, you know, just going along with our conversation because it was fun. Now after hearing that. Oh, no. He's a horror show. That has to end.
Well, I just can't stand the hagiography anymore.
Yes, no, I can't.
I don't want, because if they did that for the Patriots game, Sandra, what in God's name are they going to do with a Denver playoff game?
No, I'm just like, you know, it's like, that was Tom Brady. What, he ain't even worthy? You know, the whole thing is sickening.
Yeah, it took Saturday Night Live, and that clip I ran, it took Saturday Night Live to say, well, you know, if I'm the son of God, then, well, Tom's definitely his nephew.
No, listen, that was brilliant, that skit. Oh, I'm sure that Robinson's head exploded on that shit.
Well, I wish he would, because he's occupying prime real estate on Sandra's Gone to Glory list.
Oh yeah. Oh no, that list just gets bigger all the time. But anyway, I don't know. He has to lose more. I just can't. Anyway, so I guess that's it. I hope you have a nice Christmas.
Oh, I do too. I hope you guys do as well, Sandra. And and of course, you know, Christmas is for the children, and I hope your nieces have a wonderful time.
Oh yeah, well no, it's a whole bunch of cousins, everything, and you know, we're doing crab and turkey this time.
Oh well, yummy! I've actually been toying with the idea. I don't know if it's going to be possible. I don't know if I could even get one within 100 miles of here. I have never roasted a goose.
Oh shoot! No, I can't even say I've ever even tasted it.
And it just occurred to me, you know, that'd be kind of fun to do. But I don't know if that's going to happen. But for a lot of years we did the Alaskan king crab legs on Christmas Eve, and then breakfast is little smoked salmon toast points with capers and diced tomatoes and onions, and somewhere along the way an oyster dish and a standing rib of beef. I don't know if I'm going to be able to pull off all of that, but it'll be fun whatever it is.
Well, I'm trying to get my mother to do. Yeah, no one else eats it. They think it's disgusting, but you know, I need for her to do some chitlins. I am a fiend. Okay, I like it with the hot sauce. It's just on.
Oh, I said down there on Sapelo Island when I was gone back in the fall, there was one booth serving them up hand over fist, and I got in line because I didn't want anybody looking at me going, no, we're out now, and me not getting. No, oh my God, they were good.
Oh no, and it's and you know, because usually it's, you know, the portions tend to be kind of small. I'm like, oh no, I need
load the plate.
Yeah, if I'm somewhere where I'm like, because there's never anyone else. Everyone's so disgusted by it, because I always make sure loudly to say what the hell they are. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, because and I know how your mind works. You're running them off. More for Sandra.
That's right. And it works every damn time.
These are some mighty good intestines.
I'm sitting there. I'm having them all. Because people, yeah, they really do think, oh, God, you're so... And they're looking at me like I'm disgusting. I'm like, keep looking, take a damn picture, okay?
Because these are yummy.
I'm eating. So, yeah, you know, I know I'm terrible. What do I sound like? I'm terrible. But, yeah, that is the strategy.
Well, I'm just waiting to see. We've got a couple of more days for... Pat Robertson to come back and be further perplexed by macaroni and cheese again. That'll be a little Christmas gift in its own right.
That was a beaut, that one. Well, anyway, listen, you have a good holiday.
All right, you take care, Sandra.
Bye.
Bye now. I love the traditions that come with this time of year. Jim writing in, goose, watch out. Chitlins, good luck. No, they said. They still sell them, but I've never cooked them, and I'm afraid I would screw them up because there's a right way and a wrong way to do chitlins, and I don't know the right way, and I wouldn't trust myself to do them without expert, you know, without sitting and watching somebody who really knows what they're doing going through it the first time. But it's about 10 after the hour. Let's take a little break real quick. We'll take a little break and come back. You are listening. To America's listener-supported liberal voice, conversation radio is what we call it. It's the horn, and here it is just 4 days before Christmas. We'll be back. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Is it going? Cotton gin.
listen? Or did we really think we were right?
Tennessee. Before you send me an email saying, holy cow, Bob, who was that? The name of the song is Should Have Picked Our Own Cotton. The artist is Bob Cheevers. Bob Cheevers. Wow. Just wow. Like I said, 15 minutes past the hour. Some conversation time yet remaining this evening. If you want to get involved in the program, David in Tennessee advising, and he's damn good in the kitchen, David is. And he says, as regarding chitlins, they're like clams. To overcook is to sin. And see, that's the thing. It's nothing for amateurs. Isaac writing in, see, this is how it goes. This is how it works out. Isaac writing in, subject line, chitlins and hog maws recipe. It doesn't get any countryer than this. And you know what? It looks yummy, because I got a photograph, too. Chitlins and hog maws. Hoo-wee. Yeah, and I see it. There's some black-eyed peas in the corner of the photograph. I'm going to have to go and get those in order for New Year's Day. Superstition's fine as long as you understand, you know, why you're doing it. Chitlins, 5 pounds frozen chitlins, 1 pound hog maws, 1 small onion, 1 teaspoon of salt, 1 teaspoon white vinegar, 1 teaspoon minced garlic, 1/2 teaspoon of red pepper flakes, 16-quart boil pot, 1 cutting board, and 1 sharp knife. Well, how'd he do? Oh, that would... I wish I had someone to show me and teach me. Yeah, it doesn't get any countryer than this. Thanks, Isaac. Thanks a lot. Oh, now, let's see. You know the number, right? 877-443-2366. Let's go to the lines. Oh, lost you. Sorry about that. Chime back in if you want to. And being as how it is the holiday, and this isn't really a holiday thing, but I've seen it happen too many times inside my own family not to at least make mention of this to you. Because it's the holiday season, and we don't always have time to go out and, or, you know, sit around. You take the sticks of butter out because you want to bake cookies. You got to leave it out because you got to cream the butter and the sugar together. And that takes time and forethought and planning, and sometimes it's just too damn much. Or at least it is in my tiny mind and my severely limited organizational skills. So pay attention, because sometimes it's easier just to buy the ready-to-go-into-the-oven cookie dough. And I don't know. Okay, don't send me email calling me a sexist, all right? Because I don't intend it that way. But mostly, it's been women I've known who have had this thing for cookie dough out of the refrigerator. And just sit around and eat the unbaked cookie dough, which I personally find revolting. But some people I have known think of in the same vein as the ambrosia fed to the ancient gods of old. Well, there's a warning out. Scientists from the journal Clinical... Yeah, because you really want to hear about this, you want to hear about your food in a magazine with a name like this. Scientists from the journal Clinical Infectious Diseases found in a recent study of the 2009 E. coli outbreak that 77 people in 30 states became ill after eating Nestle's Toll House raw cookie dough. Now, that's E. coli 157H7. It can do things like shutting your kidneys down. It can kill you dead, and it's a rotten way to go, not that there are many good ones. Dr. Karen Neal is a medical epidemiologist at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. She said quite plainly, "My recommendation, the general recommendation, is that you should not consume raw cookie dough. Regardless of who makes it, whether it's made at home or as a commercial product, that is the safest thing to avoid illness." Of course, every time I see, and maybe I'm wrong, the more scientifically literate can certainly feel free to email and tell me if I am. But every time I see a warning come out that, well, you know, 82 tons of hamburger from amalgamated cow slaughter has been proven to have tested positive for E. coli, or don't eat the cookie dough because it's got E. coli in it. Well, maybe the E. coli... No, salmonella is what you have to worry about with eggs, isn't it? Help me out here. Because I know that when there's a warning that goes out and a recall that goes out about hamburger, I'm sorry to anyone who's in the dinner hour, I worry about Tracy. Maybe she's out in her cab in California somewhere enjoying one of those wonderful truck tacos. But anytime a warning goes out about beef contaminated with E. coli, that's basically a confession that the beef has been contaminated or come in contact with poo. I'm not trying to be cute and euphemistic. I just don't like the other words just right now. A little too graphic, even for me. But because E. coli exists in the gut. And the only way to get E. coli out of the gut is, well, you know the route. So when the hamburger is bad, and by the way, there is a gigantic hamburger recall on right now because corporate America can't seem to keep its hamburger out of the poo. Every time I see E. coli, I think poo. And I really can't stand the concept that Nestle's Toll House cookie dough is somehow made in a process that involves exposing it to poo. But it sure does give you pause to reflect on what it is and what it means to eat in the industrialized food system. Agnes writing in, "Don't eat the spinach either. Screw it all and go happy. Eat whatever you want. Yours truly, Agnes." Let's see. In the last couple of years, it's been peanut butter, green beans, lettuce, spinach, hamburger, 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 hamburger. We can't seem to make hamburger with it. Hey, Frank! Hey, Frank, I think you forgot to drag the hamburger through the poo. So stay out of the cookie dough, too, would you? Because it's got E. coli in it. Maybe it's in from the eggs. Maybe it's from the raw eggs. I don't know. I guess I just count. And you know, because there's cookie dough ice cream. No, bake the cookies and then crumble them up and put them in the ice cream. That's yummy. I'm surprised they're not selling Oreo dough or... Yeah. You know, I've never been okay with Oreos ever since I found out what the filling was. It's basically grease and sugar. Mmm, yum, yum. Hey, Grandpa, what's for supper? Let's have more. Randall writing in from PA, in terms of New Year's Day traditions. In Philly, on New Year's Day, it's pork chops and sauerkraut. Couldn't argue with that. We try to cover all of our bases. We have cooked cabbage and Hoppin' John with black-eyed peas and corned beef when we can afford it. That stuff's priced daily just like gold. Isn't it funny when you think about it that the 1% are throwing a hissy over a transaction tax on transactions that are meaningless? I mean, 3 cents? Really 3 cents a trade? On stuff that trades at $60, $70, $80, even if it's a 20... Let's say it's a $10 stock, it's still 3 cents. Throwing a hissy, and see, it only adds up into real money if you're talking about, and I think it was our good buddy Andy who mentioned this, if you're talking about the computer-driven transactions that involve millions upon millions of shares traded at once that no human being can do, that's the only way it matters. But the 1% pisses and moans about paying a 3 cent transaction tax on their stock trades, but they're perfectly okay with leaving 4, 5, 6, 7%, not 7 cent. That's 7 cents on the dollar, not 7 cents on the trade. The 1% are more than happy to have the poor pay 7, 8, maybe some places 10% transaction tax on the entirety of a grocery purchase. That just kind of dawned on me when I was thinking about all of this. It's okay for us to, if we have to go and buy $10 worth of groceries, for us to pay 60 cents to continue eating, to have food. Doesn't matter if it's hamburger, dry beans, rice, a jar of pickles, strawberry preserves, donuts, bananas, doesn't matter. 60 cents on $10, pay up, you damn prole. But if we ask the 1% to cough up 3 stinking pennies on a $60 stock trade, well, by God, that's communism. Oh, well, we'll stop trading stocks. We'll show you, and the stock market will fall, and everything will come apart, and we'll no longer have Frisbees or Wheat Checks. Clayton writing in, the militant sociologist says, some of us here want a 25 cent transaction tax on trades. And it still doesn't even begin to approach what the poor and the middle class and the non-investor class pay just to be able to, what were we called? Useless eaters. Yeah, useless eaters. It's things like that, when you consider things in context, that really give you a firm understanding of what the 1% mean when they say that we need to leave them alone to be job creators. Because that's what they're doing with that extra 3 cents on a $75 transaction. Why, they're creating jobs. Oh, my aching back. Just had an email in from Bill asking me problems. I guess he's having a hard time getting maybe the stream stopped coming in. Anybody else experiencing that, let me know. just let me know. 28 past the hour. Where to go? What do we want? Ron Paul. Yeah, I'm kind of Ron Pauled out, aren't you? The guy really is sickening. Let's see here. Oh, by the way, yes. Rick Goodhair Perry. Yeah, he's upset with you. Very upset. He's angry at you for suggesting that the Keystone XL pipeline might wind up being poisonous. So would you tree hugging hippies shut up? I saw that in a story earlier today. What? No, Rick Perry really is pissed off at you for saying mean, nasty things about the Keystone XL pipeline and fracking. Does that just kind of lay you low? This coming from NewHampshirePrimary.blogspot.com. Republican presidential candidate Rick Perry faced tough questions and even direct criticism from voters attending a December 18, 2011 town hall meeting in Decorah, Iowa, after he claimed that there is no proof tying groundwater pollution to hydraulic fracking. What? But, you know, God Almighty, this is Rick Perry. He says that there's no proof tying human activity to the increasing temperatures and climate change on this planet. He says that there's no science that suggests that humans evolved from previous primate species. There's a surprise here? No, but apparently he went off on about a 10-minute-long rant at the Winnesheek Hotel and Steyr Opera House about energy issues. I didn't get around to telling you about the John Deere and the new engine that the federal government has new emission standards on this new engine that John Deere is building, and it's on the nitrogen oxide level. Okay, no, really, we've got to have an official horn language parser, because that's going to take a while. I didn't get around to telling you about the John Deere and the new engine that the federal government has new emissions standards on this new engine that John Deere is building, and it's on the nitrogen oxide level. And I'll tell you that I understand about environmental protections. And I'm going to tell you just a quick story about Texas in a second, and how EPA's come in and tried to take over what we're doing in our state, and we've cleaned up our air more than any other state in the nation. Shh. Let's just go through that real quick. Could we, please? Now, we've got a number of Texas listeners, any one of whom could opine on this point, but I'll carry this weight for a moment, even though I'm not a Texan. The filthiest air in the entire nation is to be had in Texas, because they don't believe in protecting their environment. And even if they've cleaned up their air more than any other state in the nation, they still have the dirtiest air in the nation. Really? But check this transition. I'm going to tell you how EPA's come in and tried to take over what we're doing in our state, and we've cleaned up our air more than any other state in the nation. But the cost to that tractor is going to be $20,000 a copy. What, Edith?
cost to that tractor is going to be $20,000 a copy. I didn't know that. You're going to have to pay that, and I would suggest that the difference in the quality of the air that tractor is going to make is going to be minuscule at best. And the people of Iowa, I thought we were talking about Texas, the people of Iowa know better how to keep their air clean and to make sure their water is clear and drinkable than some bureaucrat in Washington, D.C. And so these regulations, whether they're bank regulations or banking, I thought we were talking about John Deere tractors. I thought we were talking about Texas, but we're talking about Iowa. And so these regulations, whether they're bank regulations or they're environmental regulations, they're strangling this country. I'll pull every regulation that has gone forward since 08, and by that he means 1808, and test it for this simple fact. Does it kill jobs or does it create jobs? Well, if he wasn't lying like the rug on his head, then if he, for instance, subjected the mercury regulations or the air particulate regulations to that kind of scrutiny, well, he'd find out that they were net job creators and he'd have to let them go forward. But that's not what he means. This is code. This is more that damn dog whistling that seems to be the entire sum and summation of right-wing politics. This is dog whistling to his... Well, no, it's more... Yeah, if dogs could whistle. This is that dog whistling to his corporate masters in the energy industry that he'll do whatever they say. Roll over, Ricky. Yeah, we're going to scratch you in the belly. Oh, who's a good politician? Who's the good governor? Oh, that's a good Ricky. Oh, yeah, oh, he loves it when we scratch him there. And if it kills jobs, we're going to get rid of them. Of course, it is a foregone conclusion in his non-logical, addle-pated, not very well-together mind, that all regulations kill jobs. Unless they're regulations that prevent regulations, and then that's a job creator. We have the ability in our states to protect our environment. And as I shared with you, we cleaned up our air more than any other state in the nation. Nitrogen oxide levels were down by 58% in the decade that we just finished. It's our people. It's our air. Yes, his people. Didn't we just have a conversation about that a little bit ago? Wasn't there a song I just played about that? Yeah, Rick Perry ain't interested in chopping none of his own cotton. So then a couple of questions come along, probably from potted plants. On the oil pipeline from Canada, tar sands down to Texas for exporting gas and oil versus exporting through British Columbia to Seattle. Exporting through British Columbia, Seattle. Well, I just asked that question myself. You know, why can't they run the pipeline through their own country? What's your pros and cons of that pipeline proposal there, Governor? I've had some pretty lengthy conversations with both the Canadians and the governors that represent the states where that pipeline will go. And not all of them, but some pretty lengthy conversations. I've been a proponent of that pipeline. Energy independence should be a goal for this country. This is just word vomit. That's the reason when I talked about I'm an all-of-the-above energy person. This guy makes less sense than Sarah Palin. I never thought we would see the day when we viewed Sarah Palin as an orator, but Rick Perry has made that day dawn. I don't think we should shut out any type of legitimate energy source. Well, let's have a discussion, Governor, about what legitimate means, could we? I'm not for giving those tax credits, but I am for developing them and removing the regulatory hurdles. And what we've got today, that oil is going to go to one of two directions. Now, pay attention, because you all know the truth about the Keystone XL pipeline. No, screw the truth. You all know the facts about the Keystone XL pipeline. Listen up. I bet you if I look over to the chat room, I'll see screaming. If I'm not careful, I'll answer the phone and it'll just be screaming. Here we go. What we've got today, that oil is going to go one of two directions. It's either going to go west and the Chinese will buy it, or it will go south for the United States consumption. The screaming has begun. Every barrel of that oil that goes south is one barrel of oil that we will not have to import from foreign countries, and in some cases, foreign countries that are hostile to this country. I mean, I look forward to the day when we can tell Mr. Hugo Chavez, no thank you, we don't need any Venezuelan oil. None. But that pipeline creates a lot of jobs. And I'm talking about jobs in the development of the pipeline. I'm talking about in the building of the pipeline. I don't agree that the president should veto this bill. He should let this pipeline occur. Truly, in many instances, the stupid is painful. It's physically painful. There's no bill. It's a permitting process that's going through the Department of State because it crosses international borders. Just is. And he has the final say-so on whether it goes forward. And I know he's being pressured by those on the radical environmental side of the aisle that want him not to build this pipeline. You know, I'm just a late 40-something guy who has a lovely wife and three beautiful children at home, teenagers. I don't know if I've even got a copy of the Internationale on this computer. I know I don't own any red flags. There's not a hard copy of the Communist Manifesto anywhere to be had in this house. Mao's little red book is not in evidence. Had to read the Communist Manifesto once for school, and that's probably when them liberals were trying to get me all indoctrinated. You know, there's just some things in this world you shouldn't read. Because, you know, that reading can be dangerous. No, kidding aside, we're all the same. We just want to live our lives and be left alone, and part of being able to live our lives and be left alone involves being able to drink water and breathe air. Because that human prototype, genotype, who is able to live without air and water has not yet evolved. Maybe someday, but not yet. But because I want to be able to breathe air and drink water and bathe in it and not have heavy metals and toxins leach through my innards and through my skin and in through the membranes of my respiratory system, because I want to do those things, Rick Perry, who has the IQ of turtle snot, thinks himself privileged by virtue of nothing more than the bottom line balance of his bank account to dare to call me and you and us and we the people radical environmentalists. Rick Perry, screw you with a red hot poker. You and the horse you rode in on, Buster. Because I am not an environmentalist, for starters. I am a humanist. And I am a human rights advocate. And I don't care how well paid Rick Perry is by the energy industry, no amount of money can supersede my right, your right, and our rights, even enshrined in the law of this nation, to breathe air and drink water and not be poisoned in the process. Radical environmental side. Kiss my foot, Rick Perry. This pipeline has been studied for at least 3 years. The information that I have on it, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that I'm an absolute expert, but the information is that it is one of the safest pipelines, if not the safest pipeline, that's ever been built. You'll notice there's a little bit of obfuscation in there. Because no matter how safe it is, he cannot say that it won't spill, ever. Remember the story last night about the 60-foot geyser of oil? Yeah. And there are already pipelines that go across the Ogallala Aquifer in Nebraska, which the bone of contention that is that which the bone of contention that they're making. So this pipeline needs to be built. We need to be looking for every source of energy. So they've already got pipelines that are a threat to the Ogallala Aquifer. Therefore, we should have more threatening pipelines to the Ogallala Aquifer. Again, C student, logic class, still don't wash. Only 8% of the proven reserves on our federal lands, and I understand there are places in our federal parks where we're not going to be exploring. I mean, we're not going to be going into the Everglades. We're not going into Yellowstone. Really? Don't check that one there, Rick. And I would use a substantial amount, if not all of that revenue, coming into the federal government to help pay down the debt. But the revenue is minuscule. He went on and on and on. Voter, in reference to natural gas, you talked about how there's a huge natural gas deposit. It's been proven that that technology to extract that energy has polluted groundwater. No, ma'am. Voter, yes, sir, it has. Rick Perry, no, ma'am. We can have this conversation, but you cannot show me one place where there is a proven, not one, where there is a proven pollution of groundwater by hydraulic fracking. Voices of other voters in the room. That's false. That's just false, sir. Rick Perry. Bring me the paper. Show me the paper. I'm just telling you, I am truly offended that the American public would be hoodwinked by stories that do not scientifically hold up. And see, that's another one of those atheist moments, because if the guy with the lightning bolts or the hammers or the, I don't know, anvils, pianos, what have you, was really up there in the sky, greasy spot, Rick Perry. Well, you're now speaking with the former candidate, now greasy spot, Rick Perry, who told lies in front of God and everybody and was just smitten. I am truly offended that the American public would be hoodwinked by stories that do not scientifically hold up. You mean like creationism, Rick? Or the idea, well, it's not really scientifically, it's historically, but the idea that Phyllis Schlafly is more important than Thomas Jefferson in your Texas history books? Rick? We have been using hydraulic fracturing in my home state for years, and this is a fear tactic that the left is using and the environmental community is using to absolutely excuse the pun, but does not hold water. Voters again. That's not true. Rick Perry. Bring me the evidence. And once you do that, you show it to me, and I'll be the first to say you've got a point. Well, you know what? How about northeastern Pennsylvania? How about out west where the EPA finally just said, well, yeah, it does. Maybe we could get Governor Rick to sit down and watch a little bit of Josh Fox's seminal film, Gasland.
and see the fella lighting his tap water on fire as he opens the faucet. Within 24 hours, CBS News had posted a story answering Governor Perry's challenge, linking to a December 8, 2001 story bearing the headline, EPA suspects fracking linked to pollution. So I guess maybe to the extent that I wanted to take a picture of one of those Ron Paul voters, well, there are at least some semi-normal people in Iowa, and I know they're there. Because they actually stood up and challenged Rick Perry when he started openly lying to them. So maybe there's a little bit of hope. A little bit. Oh, by the way, since it is the holiday season, I wanted to mention something to you. And by the way, happy solstice yesterday to everybody. First day post-solstice now. Each day will get a little bit longer. A reason for hope. I was reading an article based on remarks given by Fred Edwards in 2005 called Celebrating Our Humanism. It's an excellent compendium explaining just everything that went into our holidays and why we celebrate the holidays we celebrate and why our holidays all seem to fall around critical, calendrical, seasonal shifts or changes, transitions. He notes that the Romans celebrated Saturnalia from December 17th to the winter solstice, which then was recognized as falling on December 23rd. So, in addition to Happy Hanukkah, which is going on now, Happy Saturnalia. But he also notes that somewhere along the way, humanists decided that they needed their own holiday. And lo and behold, there's a holiday worth celebrating coming tomorrow night. It is called the Human Light Festival. And it is celebrated on December 23rd. And so if you feel like you're kind of left out by all the religion and hoopla of this season, just remember that human light is celebrated by humanists and rationalists and so forth on December the 23rd. It's a specifically humanist winter celebration. And enjoy yourself if you choose to celebrate it. So, and by the way, I just got a note in from Rick Smith's producer, Brett. He says, no show on the Horn stream tonight. I'm 2 hours from our PC, and it had to reboot. The remote reboot failed. So, yeah, it's not a problem on our end this time. It says it won't be back until Monday. So no Rick Smith tomorrow night, no Rick Smith tonight, so you get stuck with the rerun of this program immediately following the close of this program if you don't go to listen somewhere else. Thanks to all of you for joining in this evening. I sincerely appreciated it and enjoyed the conversation. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this happen, all of the volunteers that complete the all-volunteer effort that is the Horn. Thanks to our chat room moderator, Lottie, and our chat room moderator, Sparky. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to our blogger, Texas Betsy. Again, happy Hanukkah. Thank you to our op-ed columnist, Reverbo, who sent me along, as I said, that article about the Human Light Festival in context with the human urge to be festive. Thanks to my head writer, David in Tennessee. Thanks to John Fox, celebrating the Christmas season down there in Australia with his beloved ones. Thanks to Ben Birch, who I guess will be getting some badly needed relaxation downtime this season as well. He's been working like a wild man. He needs to take care not to overdo that. Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. It'll be almost 10 years now that the White Rose Society stepped up when no one else was doing so and made sure that liberal and progressive talk radio survived on the internet, though it has such a hard time surviving on the terrestrial public-owned airwaves. And of course you know why. Ben has never sent a bill for all that he has done at WhiteRoseSociety.org. And his is an act of untrammeled heroism and patriotism, I would say. Thanks, Ben. Thanks, of course, go out to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. You can go to crmw.net and learn about everything that Coal River Mountain Watch is doing, from the Coal River Wind Project to all of our efforts to end the horror that stalks these Appalachian hills in the form of the relentless, remorseless search for unholy profit by the filthy coal industry. You can join the email list, and I urge you to do so. You can buy one of the coolest T-shirts there is. Everybody wants one whenever they see one. Save the endangered hillbilly. You can even contribute to the cause. Most importantly, though, if you sign up, you'll get the emails, and that's important because when you take action, you become a part of the solution. So thanks again for these ongoing years of support from Coal River Mountain Watch. And always, 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 and a reminder, live show tomorrow night. We'll be here. Hope you will be too. Always, Gina, Judy, it's all for you.
WFNW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Yes, it's going to be one of those weeks. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn, the Head-On Radio Network, America's liberal voice, the home of the incredibly unique conversation radio that is unlike just about anything happening in broadcast anywhere at any time. It's going to be one of those weeks where every time we press the buttons, we just kind of have to stick our tongues out just right and hold one arm up in the air and stand on our toes and just hope that everything connects. For a while there, it looked like nothing was going to connect, but, well, it did. And I'm here, and you're there, and I'm grateful for all of it. I'm very thankful for both ends of that whole process. It's about 3 minutes past...